If there is any part of the Bible that you are afraid of, I would guess it's the minor prophets.
I'd like to begin with a trigger warning.
This is
completely, utterly mad.
You're gone.
Insane.
Such a genius.
Impossible.
Someone needs to save this
man. If you're doing what everyone else is doing, you're doing it wrong.
The greatest epics ever produced.
Well, get ready. You ain't seen nothing yet.
And yeah, I can understand how you'd be like, well, that's not fair, Pastor Fisk. I'm afraid of Leviticus, right? Yeah, okay, sure. And you should be, because it's a daunting book. And, you know, that one time you tried to read the Bible all the way through, or that two times or three times, the place where it gets hard is Leviticus, end of Exodus, really. And then Numbers, Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy's a little better, but still pretty tough. And then, of course, you get into Joshua. It picks up. Judges, it's a good story, but dear heavens, what is going on? And then you get to David and Saul and the Samuel text. And, they, you know, that gets a little more fun again. And then somewhere around, I don't know, 2 Chronicles, your eyes have glazed over again. 2 Chronicles is probably by the end of 2 Kings. Your eyes have glazed over again. They don't really come back. Isaiah, you pick up for a moment because it's like, oh, I remember that text from Advent, but oof, man, this is rough, right? And if you ever even got that far, the minor prophets just kind of are a bad memory. And what I mean by this is that regardless of who you are, unless you happen to be a scholar who specializes in that particular segment of the Bible, there's just a good chance that you could stand to learn a thing or two about the minor prophets. And I'm definitely in this boat. I'm so much in this boat that I'm spending a grand amount of time developing an entire Old Testament course for my congregation, running from every sermon for a year through Bible study through confirmation class, just so I can have to study the minor prophets. I mean, there's other good reasons in it as well. I certainly want my people and you, as so far as you're able to tag along for the journey, to enhance your understanding of the Old Testament in general. I think that we are severely lacking in our confidence as Christians, in part because we don't know our history. And our history not only includes the Reformation, and we can all go, yay, Luther, right? At least a little bit. But the martyrs, the early church, the fathers, these are important things. New Testament, you know, the book of Acts, we maybe know it a touch, not as much as we should, but we definitely know it more than we know the Old Testament. The Old Testament, if you were an old school Sunday school attendee, you know kind of the basics. You know the basics. You know the high points. You know the mountaintops. If you're a new school Sunday school attendee, that's maybe more fair to say, you know, kind of the basics. Yeah, yeah. You maybe heard the name David, and you're like, yeah, Goliath, right? Like, you can do that much, but you might be missing quite a few other things. And it's not entirely your fault. This has a lot to do with the Dewey Decimal System, believe it or not. Mr. Dewey, who renovated American education, has had his long-lasting effect. Initially, the effects maybe weren't as visible as they have become, but it certainly, well, segregated the classrooms first and foremost, kids from parents and then age from age, and gradually compelled us to believe that the child enjoying the process is more important than actually doing anything in the process. And that led us to be subject to our children, which led us to be entertainers to our children, trying to keep them happy in any way, shape, or form that we can. Now, this is in the home as well, I suppose, and it's not all Dewey's fault, but it certainly is what has happened to the Sunday school curriculum and planning and programming and youth group and all this stuff, so that at the end of the day, did you have fun is the important question. And at the end of the day, it means that you have no clue afterwards who Habakkuk is. Absolutely not, right? Yeah, exactly. So, I cannot promise to entirely fix that problem for you, not today or maybe ever, but I can promise that I'm going to try to make an effort to fix it a little bit for me. And so what I'm doing now is I'm going through the Bible study, which we were going to deal with at St. Paul in Rockford on this particular Sunday, in order to try to help me remember it. A lot of people think that when a pastor gets up there, does Bible study, he just has it all in his head. Well, that's true for some things. There are things that are definitely there you can just recall. But the blind spots, not so much. And the first time you learn something, I mean, when I was 20 and I learned something, I could hold it pretty well. But, you know, these old bones and this gray matter is not quite the same thing. And so, I mean, I've told you this before. Like for the sermon on Daniel for this series, I had to go back and listen to my own podcast. Because I was like, how do I remember that? I don't remember that. I want to know what I knew, right? And so part of that, the real learning to really hold it, involves repetition, right? It's not just the one time through. It's not just the podcast you do. It's teaching it several times. So I'm actually cheating right now too. I'm doing this right now to try to help me remember it. And I'm sorry to use you in this horrifically selfish way. But hopefully at the end of the day, you like being used. Right? And let the reader understand and laugh and not get too triggered by all this kind of stuff. So here's the thing. The time period of the minor prophets is made difficult by the placement of the books, right? So to understand where these things fit in the Bible is made difficult by where the books are in the Bible. We are so attuned to chronological order, to having things be in the order in which they happened, then told to us in the order in which they happened, that we kind of know intuitively as we get to the back of the Old Testament, it's not really working that way, but we don't really know how to answer the problem because the only way for us to comprehend it is to have it chronologically. So we can like be told all these things about why it is the way it is, and we can be told, oh, that happened there and that happened there and that happened there, but to retain that without a calendar, that's pretty tough for a Western person to do. And I think that's part of my problem. I don't know that I'm solving that today at all. But it certainly is kind of where you need to go a little bit here. You got to know where the context is. And this is always the case for the books of the Bible anyway, isn't it? I mean, if you don't know the context, then how can you know what it means? If you don't know what it meant, how can you know what it means today? And yeah, sure, there's a lot of Christians who don't care about that at all. And they just say, well, I think it means this, or I feel it means that. Yeah, good for you. Yeah. I can pull a wet noodle out of a hat too. It doesn't make me a magician. And so finding where these prophets were is really our first step in trying to gather who they were and what they were saying and who they were saying it to. And then the first thing to know then is that they were not all together, not even close. They are spread all over the place, and they are living and prophesying at the same time as some of the other quote unquote major prophets who they may have known each other, but maybe didn't know other major prophets. So you almost think like, oh man, Jeremiah and Isaiah and Ezekiel must have been buddies, right? They just hung out all the time. No. They were living at different times, different places, and that's the case with the minor prophets as well. Although some of them did interact with each other, and they interacted with various kings, some of whom we talked about here, some of whom we have not talked about here. And to even get into that then, we have to understand, why am I even calling them minor prophets and major prophets?
You're doing it wrong.
It's almost insulting. Yeah, who are you? Well, I'm a prophet of God. Majors or minors? Well, I play in the bush leagues, but I'll get there someday. You know, like my word of God isn't quite up to snuff. It bats about 500, 400. Well, that's pretty good for baseball, but for prophecy, it's kind of weak. So, but someday, if I train hard, right? That's not really what we mean by that. The only reason those terms exist is out of the Greek and Latin thinking, and maybe the word mega, and I don't know what the minor word is. But mega, you know the word mega. Mega made, right? And if you got that Easter egg, well then, I won't say the next word, but, good for you. mega meaning like large. Yeah. Not better, right? Large. And, megalodon. There he goes. Another one. You know, it's just really big. And so the major prophets, although it's not the same word, it might be though, that J and G might have an etymological connection. I don't know. I'd have to look that up. I don't want to. But the major prophets are just big books. That's it. Not big men, big books. And the minor prophets are just small books. That's all we mean by that. So we're not thinking they're the better and the lesser. We should probably refer to them as something like the longer and the shorter. We could call them the solid declarations and the epitome, if that was more fun, yeah, for you Lutheran nerds out there. But okay, so that's the first thing. They're not lesser prophets. They just have shorter books. And they're all grouped together as they are mostly because of an issue dealing with paper. And I've touched on this in various places. It's in a book that I've started writing that I may never finish. It is an important concept, though, which is that in the ancient world, the location of your content in your scroll may have had a lot more to do with the length of the content than with the content of the content. Yeah. Today, it's really important to put the most important thing first, say it there, and then prove it in the middle, and then say it again at the end, right? That's called having a thesis for you 7th and 8th graders who hate grammar. And it's very important to how we understand everything. Commercials do it. I mean, everything does it one way or the other. You have a hook. Of course, you have a hook. But after the hook, you get to your content, and you say your main thing right away. That isn't necessarily the case with ancient layouts, because they had to take space into consideration. And so you couldn't put Isaiah and his compatriot, who I don't even have, it's in my notes down below, but I haven't scrolled down to it. I don't even remember who he is, but his compatriot minor prophets, you couldn't put them in the same scroll. They wouldn't fit. Yeah. And so all these guys get clumped into one book because, not one book, all these guys get clumped into one area in the back of the Old Testament because they are all clumped into one book that is one scroll. And this one scroll was called the Book of the Twelve. The Book of the Twelve. And that's still, I think, how Hebrews refer to it today. I'd rather refer to that it that way as well. That is what I'm calling it in the Bible study officially. This is the Book of the Twelve. There are 12 of these shorter, more epitomized prophets. Yeah. And then from there, that segment we can realize does not exist in any chronological order, but it all took place over the course of a single 400-year period. Now, let's put that in context as well. 400 years is a time frame that we Americans cannot rightly comprehend. 400 years ago, what is that, 1620, 1619? I'm not even sure what was going on in this country at that point. You know, pilgrims were... Was that Pilgrim times? 1492, Columbus is here. You get the early settlers in the 1500s, you know, the Jamestown and the Charlestown and all this kind of stuff, which is which, I can't remember. This is such a fun story, I will tell it. Hold on, sip of coffee. This is such a fun story. So my wife and I, before we were married, dated a little bit. We got married fairly fast, and it's gone well. But we were playing Trivial Pursuit at my parents' house, and it was late at night. She was staying, sleeping on the couch. I was going to sleep in my room. You know, we were down from college where she was at, and we're playing Trivial Pursuit. And the question I was something like, you know, what was the first settlement commissioned by King? And I don't remember now, even if it was King James or King Charles. I think it was by King Charles and King Charles of England or whoever. I don't even know where he's from, but I know I could answer the question, because what was the first settlement in, you know, in the Americas commissioned by him? This is a softball, right? And my beloved, she's marvelous and she's very intelligent. So I only tell this story because I know that, she can handle it and she's very intelligent and it's funny. She goes, Is it Charlestown? Wait. King Charles? Jamestown. Oh my goodness. It was fantastic. And I was like, is that your answer? She's like, yeah. Stop. So anyhow, I think that's before the 1600s still. I'm just trying to put us in that context again. Pilgrim times. We cannot fathom how far back this is for us. We can't even really comprehend George Washington times, although we're a little better able to kind of feel the distance from that time. Although I think for a lot of young people, it's just kind of like there's us and the boomers and none have ever existed before us. And the boomers are really weird, but they had like TV and stuff. So they're okay. Right. And that's kind of where we're at. So to understand the length of a 400-year period is just something we as a nation are not able to do yet. And that's the distance that goes on for these guys. And in the middle of this distance, this timeline, is the destruction of Jerusalem. It's not like they were all there just until Jerusalem fell. They're going to end up in the exile as well and doing work both in the exile and even after the exile. So the stretch is pretty significant. And without at least a cursory understanding of what I mean when I say exile, it gets a little difficult to comprehend even that, right? Now, I've been trying here, at least. I don't know how much of this has leaked over into what I've been doing for you. I think some of it has. I've been trying here, at least, to make that exile concept a major part of our Old Testament learning for the year. Because there really are only two Old Testament paradigms you need to know in which everything else fits. And you could say three. I suppose there's three. There is Exodus. There is the exile. And then there is the kingdom of David, right? And everything else is leading to or coming from that. Now, I'm not trying to diminish the flood or anything about Moses' early writings, but those writings come from the time of the Exodus, right? So we're still connected to Moses. So you got Moses, and you have David. And then you have the prophets, and you even have the splitting up of the Bible as a whole, the Old Testament Bible as a whole, into segments that reflect this. At least is the way the Hebrews did it. You know, they had the Torah, the writings, and the Ketuvim, the Nevi'im, the prophet. The Ketuvim is, sorry, I got thrown off by saying Torah. Torah is Hebrew, right? Ketuvim is Hebrew for writings, and then Nevi'im is Hebrew for prophets. So that's like the major divisions in the Old Testament. And each of those then has like this contextual reality tied to it, this story that is tied to it. And yeah, creation, fall, redemption is all of it. But then you have Exodus, you have exile, and you have kingdom. And without question, exile is the blind spot, right? For modern Christians. We put a lot of emphasis in what we do teach, which isn't ever enough, I think. But we put a lot of emphasis on Exodus. So I think many of the kiddies, they probably have an idea about the Red Sea. Like they can kind of like, oh yeah, that thing, right? It's lost in the Marvel timeline, and they're not sure where it fits with when Iron Man rose to prominence, but they know that it happened, right? So that's important. But then exile, I mean, who knows? So again, having this understanding that it's as big a deal as the Exodus. Maybe bigger. When St. John writes the Revelation, the imagery that he draws on comes from the entire Bible. There's no question about that. But, this is just a from the hip hunch here. I've not done the word search or done the PhD research on this yet. Don't plan to. Maybe not PhD, at least I don't plan to. He draws at a higher rate from the exile timeline imagery than from the Exodus imagery. The Exodus stuff is there too, and it goes by so fast you almost miss it. There's all sorts of references to it. But the big, big baddie is not Egypt. It's Babylon, right? It's Babylon. Babylon is the one who falls. Babylon is where the harlot has her thrown upon the beasts, all that kind of stuff, right? Even Rome, Rome's a big part of it too in some ways, but the name never gets there. Babylon's the name. And Babylon is the issue with the exile. By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when our captors demanded of us a song. Sing us one of the songs of Zion. But how can we sing in a foreign land? Oh, it's so good. That theme is at the heart of all the prophets, really. It's leading to and coming out of this. And it's at the middle then of this 9th to 5th century BC territory in which these minor prophets did their work. Yeah. So, now to try to give that just one more touch of context, that means that the first prophets, as we have as... I got that. That means I got to talk about this. Sorry. Tangent.
Whoop, stop.
One thing I have neglected to mention is that we don't have all the writings of the prophets. Without question, we know from what the prophets and the writings and the Torah tell us that there were other prophets. Prophets whom God sent. Some of them we know by name. Some of them we don't know by name. We just know what they said. And what they said is written, say, somewhere in Samuel, right? But in terms of who they were, what they did, why they should be trusted, none of that is necessarily there. And so we also know then of some who were named, and did they write something? Probably not. Writing wasn't kind of the thing quite back then. It was hard to do, but they might have. But the thing is, we don't have all the prophets. So when we talk about the prophets, we just got to realize that we have the written ones and the unwritten ones. All right, tangent concluded. So that was important because of what I'm going to say next. The rise of the prophets, so far as I'm going to talk about it, from the 9th to the 5th century BC, is not equivalent to prophecy in the Old Testament. And I'm not going to dive right now into the distinction between the Old Testament and New Testament eras, when it comes to prophecy and no prophecy. That's for another time, another place. You can Google that. You can Google cessationism if you really want to read about it. There's others who've done work on it. Much of it's dated. But, you know, there's this book I'm always recommended, A Evaluation of the Claims to the Charismatic Gifts by Douglas Judish. You got to call Fort Wayne Seminary to get a copy of it, which is really unfortunate, but that's the way it is. In any case, without diving into all of that, just to see that there were prophets for sure before the 9th century BC, but then these ones who we have as written arose then. And then they arose beginning in the timeline under the reigns of Joram in the north, and then, lest you be confused, Joram in the south. Yeah, right. Yeah, this is why no one likes the era of the kings. You got Jehoiakim, you got Jehoiachin, and it's just like, what is going on, right? And we're really in trouble now, because if we go with Jehoiakim being J1 and Jehoiachin being J2, well, the Jorams came before these guys, and now they're Jija and Jijija, right? What do you do with this, right? In any case, let's just leave it there for now. They start during the time of the Jorams. They're reigning over the divided kingdom, north and south. Do you not know what the divided kingdom is? It's part of what leads to the exile, and it's the end of the kingdom period. After Solomon, David's son, has a son named Rehoboam, which is also a little odd. You'd remember it fine, except for that it sounds way too much like Jeroboam, right? And the Rehoboam's the guy who's born of Solomon. Jeroboam is the guy who rebels against Rehoboam. So R in the south, J in the north. Jeroboam also comes from the tribe of Ephraim, which is pretty important given the history of Ephraim as the warrior leaders of the entire nation of Israel. So when they're shouting, like, you know, why are we following David? Like, does David do the fighting or do we? Right? That's kind of part of the rising up of the north against the south in this matter. And this is doubly important because Ephraim isn't just some random hack corner tribe like Naphtali, right? I mean, who's Naphtali? He's got a weird name, doesn't he? Naphtali. Let's make fun of him when he's not around. Ephraim, first off, you make fun of him. You can do it when he's not around. He's going to beat you up, right, when he shows up as a tribe. But his dad was Joseph. And Joseph was sort of the dude, right? I mean, he really was. If you're looking back, I mean, Judah, I mean, yeah, Judah is a lion's cub. Good for you, Judah. Joseph rules the whole planet. Yeah, he's got a little going on. And so Ephraim, you know, sitting there in Jeroboam, when God actually stirs this up against Rehoboam too, to some extent, and his punishment for Solomon and his loving of foreign wives that lead to his, what was it, a falling away? Did he repent? That's another story altogether. And we're going to take up some of it a little bit later. Not all of it, some of it. So, well, stay tuned.
There's more.
But in any case, you got that split happening north and south. From then on, you have two kingdoms, right? Two kingdoms. The two-kingdom period, or the divided kingdom, the Jorams are reigning in north and south in that. This is significantly down the timeline. And honestly, I can't place it immediately for you because I don't know the Jorams that well myself, and I only got my notes. But let's just say that at that time period, there's something else happening. There's a guy named Elisha living. Yeah, and there's not a guy named Elijah living. Did God do this on purpose? I didn't even I mean, I always knew Elisha and Elijah were difficult, but until I started right now trying to work through this for you, how many tripwires are here when it comes to the names? So Elijah is the guy who raises the widow's son, who has the prophet's duel, who goes up to heaven in a chariot of fire. You know, the British have that great song about, like, marathons and stuff or whatever. Sorry, if you're an Anglophile, I'm only half serious in that snark. it's a good song. I know that. It's a good movie. So that's Elijah. And then Elisha is the one who gets his mantle, right? When Elijah hears the voice whispering to him on the mountain of Zion. Oh, sorry, that was totally a heretical lie. I'm sorry. On the mountain of Sinai. He's very likely at Sinai. When he hears that voice whispering to him, not in his heart. I just talked about this, didn't I? Not in his heart. It's outside his head. He can hear it with his ear bones. So when he hears that voice tells him to anoint Jeroboam. No, it anointed Jehu. Sorry, Jehu. Whew. Anoint Jehu. This is about the northern tribes and their king. And he actually overthrows the house of Jeroboam and punishes them because of their connections to, say, Jezebel, stuff like that. And then you have, I'm losing his name now, a guy from Syria who's also going to be invading from the north and causing trouble. He's supposed to anoint him. And then he's supposed to go and find this Elisha guy and make him the main prophet. Right? Not writer, but prophet after him. So while Elisha is living among the 10 tribes, and who's Elisha? We know him, but not quite the same way as Elijah. He's not as famous, although he in some ways was stronger because he got a double portion of Elijah's spirit. So he's the guy who's inside of Jerusalem when the armies of Assyria are surrounding it and his friends like, hey man, we're going to die. He's like, no, we're not. And he's like, yeah, we are. Look at the army. He's like, look again. And there's this massive hordes of flaming angels, right, around the army. He's like, oh, well, like, I guess if they don't kill us and they kill them, then we're all right. Yeah. He's that guy. He's the guy who Naaman the Syrian comes to. Naaman's the guy with leprosy. He's like this warrior up in is it Assyria or Assyria? Is it? I thought it was Assyria. Nope. Commander of the army of the king of Syria. Yeah. Wonder why I thought it was Assyria. Anyway, he's a warrior. He's well established. He's wealthy and he's got leprosy. So his life's really pretty tough. And he comes down. He sees Elisha because he's been told by a servant of his who is familiar. Is the servant a Hebrew? I can't remember that either. Man, where is that there? Yeah. A little Hebrew girl. God bless her. And so he is. He comes down, he talks to him, he gets all upset because Elisha says, hey, go wash in the river, you'll be fine. And he's like, that river is really small and weak, and we got this big river up there, why would I do that? And his other servant's like, well, maybe this guy's like a mutant superpower man of God with real forces of nature behind him, and it's not the water's power so much as the word that he spoke to you. Shouldn't you maybe try it? Trust a little bit. See if it works. And he goes and he's cleaned and just don't miss the how can water do such great things and word of God power going on there, baptismal regeneration. He comes up a believer, man. It's crazy stuff. In any case, that's Elisha. So Elisha is the guy who is in action at the time that these other minor, smaller books, prophets, start going. Yeah? You with me so far? Now, when you come to these in your Old Testament, you do indeed have them in chronological order. Except, not really, but kind of. And I don't know if that makes it easier or harder. For me so far, that's made it harder. the twists within the truth make it harder than if it was just a bold-faced lie, right? And so, to figure out where they really sit, it does almost require memorization. And my hope in doing this is to memorize them in their context within the story, right? If I can remember where they were by connecting them to the king, not only will it help me remember them, it'll probably help me remember the king. Yeah? And I'm hoping you get a touch of that too as we go. But just, they are generally in chronological order, but then not. The issue with size ordering, which happens a lot where you have the largest first and the smallest last, isn't quite in play here yet. That's not something that was apparently part of that system just yet. That does happen much later, really impacts the New Testament strongly, but it's not here yet. And then it is chronological, but then there's a twist or three coming our way. All right. So there are then really chronological groupings taking place. Yeah. So, this gets, I hate to say it, even more confusing.
Right.
And it's so Hebraic, the way that this happens, they're placed into, if I'm understanding this correctly, three groupings. And you're going to like this part, that these groupings are in chronological order. But you're not going to like this part. They have no real form to them other than a chronological significance. That is, there are three time periods into which these groupings fit. They are the pre-exile period, which could also be called the Assyrian period, because during that same time, Assyria in the north is God's hand of judgment against northern Israel, and to some extent against Judah as well. And there's some cool story behind that. We may touch on that. But then you have, along with this Assyrian pre-exile period, the Chaldean slash Babylonian period, the exile itself, right? Remember, Chaldeans, Babylonians, same thing. And then you have the post-exile slash return period, which goes for quite a while. It's not like this little tiny thing that just happens in a generation, but you have that as well. And the three groupings of the Book of the Twelve are setting each of the prophets into the correct placement according to that chronology. But just for fun, that's where the chronology stops.
Right.
Within the group, they're not in chronological order all the time. Just sometimes. Why not? Yeah. And it's because the grouping, the intention is that the content is dominating the order. So you're getting like a thematic picture, which may or may not be happening in line with the theme of history itself, but it might be. And in the case where it is, you stick with that. And then the other prophets are kind of interspersed in there based on their content. So it's a major one at the front of the group to say what the theme of that time period is, followed by others that support that theme. And then they're in the time period order so far as the big picture is concerned, but then again, down on the ground, you want like the theme of the era, the zeitgeist, really, you could say. Yeah? I love that word. You know, have you noticed that? I love that word. Absolutely. All right. Inside of these groupings, you also have pairings. So you have a 1-2-1-2.
Right.
And this 1-2-1-2 has a rhyme to it, a reason to it. It's just not one that we would normally choose, because this is one of the main reasons that they're not in chronological order. The books will alternate between a prophet whose primary ministry was to the northern kingdom of Israel, and a prophet whose primary ministry was to the southern kingdom of Judah. So you have this north-south, north-south, back-and-forth ping-pong game going. And then, to make that even more clear, the headliner, the first book in each of these three major chronological sections, is the book that gives the overall theme of the time period and all of the prophecies within that section. So, for example, Hosea, or as it's rightly pronounced, Hoshea, he prophesied to the northern kingdom during the reign of Jeroboam II, of Israel, right? Northern kingdom is Israel, from 790 to 725, give or take, which timeline-wise, that's a good 100 years after Obadiah shows up prophesying to Joram of Judah. But thematically, for that time period, and they are in the same time period in the same segment here, right? Book one of the Book of the Twelve. It's not book one. What is it? Section one. What do you call that in a novel? I should know this. You know, you have like this major segment, part one. Right? Part one of the Book of the Twelve. There it is. They're in the same segment. Obadiah came first, but Hosea is pushed to the front of the segment, because like Romans does for the Pauline epistles, although that has to do with size as well, like that, it is a demonstration of the whole. Everything that's going to come after is kind of given right here at the start. And that's going to continue through these other segments as well, so that the exile segment and the post-exile segment, they all have a book at the front that demonstrates the theme of what's going to follow afterwards. And again, Hosea then is in the north, and he is followed by Joel. And Joel is a prophet who prophesied to the south, to Judah, during the reign of Joash. Now, I've just dropped three more issues that make all of this confusing. You got the issues of chronology. You got the issues of small books without a lot of story in them. And then you have the issue, which we've already touched on it a number of other places, the names, particularly the names of the kings. Because trying to understand the minor prophets means trying to put them in their context. That means putting them into an era of either the north or the south of the divided kingdom of Israel, which means understanding what's going on at that time, which means knowing who is king. And knowing who is king is easier said than done, given that all of their names, not all of their names, but many of them have names that just happen to sound like the names of other kings. To the point where even, did we say it earlier? I can't remember. There's a time when you have the same named king on the throne in each place. You got Joram in the north and Joram in the south. Well, that makes it fun. And just when you think you know what's going on, it throws you a curveball because Joram isn't always Joram. At least in Judah. Sometimes he's Jehoram.
Right.
You know, a few extra letters. No problem for us English readers. We'll figure it out, right? All their stories are so fascinating. Jeroboam II, the one northern king we've mentioned so far, during whose time frame Hosea starts prophesying, right? And that's kind of where your Book of the Twelve is going to start. Think Pulp Fiction back in time moment, except it's forward in time moment, isn't it? In Pulp Fiction, yeah. But it's like that, right? We're going to forward in time? It is forward in time. Jumping ahead? Jumping behind? Jumping ahead. Forward in time moment later in the story? Yeah. Hosea comes on the scene. Jeroboam II is a descendant of Jeroboam I. Ah, go figure. But he's not his immediate descendant. It's not his son. Jeroboam I is more famous, and it's a name you really should know, because understanding the divided kingdom can't really happen without understanding Jeroboam I. The challenge with understanding Jeroboam I is probably that the king in the south at that time is Rehoboam.
Right.
For fun. Now, keep in mind that for the Hebrews, these names would have sounded very different because they had different meanings. They had some of the meaning of the name was the same, but other meanings were different. Yeah. I will say that one of my complaints about Hebrew when I was learning it is that it kind of all does sound the same. And that people who love Hebrew will tell you, no, it doesn't. It's completely different. It's like, yeah, there's not a lot of variety in the sound choices you get to use. Yeah, so when they're rhyming stuff, and they do it every once in a while, it's it's more like a pun than a rhyme. In any case, Jeroboam I, J, right? Rehoboam, the only, R. Rehoboam, R, the only, is the son of a guy you do know, Solomon, right? Solomon, the son of David, not the only son, but the one who ascends the throne, the wisest man who ever lived, who made a few unwise decisions, and did he come back to faith? Well, I kind of have been convinced so, but you know, there's an argument to be made there. To be sure, he did not come back to faith in time for all of his "listen to my wisdom, my son" words, which we have in the book of Proverbs, and you should listen to, for all of that to impact his son Rehoboam. And Rehoboam, you know this story even if you don't know his name, right? He's like, I'm king now. Let me figure out what I should do. Let's ask my advisors from my father. And they're all like, well, people are suffering. You know, maybe tax them a little less. Let them know you love them. Show them you're a good king and see what happens. And then his friends are like, yeah, that's bad advice. You know, have you read this book, The Prince by Machiavelli? You should read it. And you got to tax him. Tax him, make him suffer, tell him that whatever he did to you that was hard, you're going to be more hard, and make it clear that you're the king. So that's what he does, and Jeroboam's out there listening. And Jeroboam's like, yeah, no, not going to do that. Now, tying this all together is the fact that this is God doing this in the first place. Not so much like God wants to divide the kingdom, but God is going to punish Solomon for his taking of foreign wives, which led him into idolatry and the worshiping of false gods. Again, not the wisest thing he could have ever done. It's such a mystery, isn't it? In any case, that punishment is going to come to pass on on his son, Rehoboam. And so Jeroboam is actually anointed by God for this task, to rebel against Rehoboam and Judah. Making this, I think, Game of Thrones style interesting is that Jeroboam's not just any old Israelite.
No doubt the facts have been exaggerated.
He's not from, again, some random tribe like what? Gad? Egad, right? And hey, if you know you're descended from Gad, I'm not upset with you. But you know, it's not like you really made a dent in history, you know? So in any case, he's not from one of those. He's an Ephraimite. And you as an American are like, so what? They didn't make a mark on history either. Well, they kind of did. And you gotta take a half a step back though, and if you really don't know, just realize, wow, I'm probably biblically ignorant. I probably am. And that's why I don't understand what Fisk is talking about. And that's not bad, but this is like really kind of key. It's this kind of connection point that betrays just how far we are as American Christianity, American Lutheran, whatever you want to call us, how far removed we are from our faith. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying we're not believers, but the fact that we don't know why Ephraim's important at all, and don't even like kind of consider it cool. You know, you're not like, I want to be like the Ephraimites. That's an interesting thing. And there's actually reason to not be like the Ephraimites as well. But, well, the Ephraimites, like the Manassites, who have a different problem, are the sons of Joseph. And I know you know who Joseph is, because his story is pretty baller, right? Like, that is an epic narrative right there. And it is the tone-setting reality to bring to, like, high point finale conclusion, the book of Genesis, which is a threefold epic. I mean, there's a lot that goes on in it, but it is a threefold epic. It is the epic of Abraham and Jacob. Isaac kind of gets a little short shrift in the storytelling. Jacob and Joseph. Those are the three major stories post-flood in Genesis. In terms of structure and all that, that's not what I'm talking about. But like in terms of epic stories, they're there. And so the setup here is, well, God's going to bring salvation through Abraham. God's going to bring salvation through Israel, Jacob. And now look, here's this amazing son, Joseph, who has his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, get a double portion of the promises at the death of Jacob, at the death of Israel. Both of these boys are made equal partakers with all the other 11 sons of Israel in the promises, in what they're going to inherit in the land, in their being part of the covenant. They are Jacob's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, but they're also Joseph's sons, right? And it's even better than that, because these epics that have been taking place throughout Genesis, I mean, it doesn't so much happen with Abraham in quite the same way, but it's hinted at there, I think, a little bit with the miraculous birth of Isaac, the unexpected son born. And really, is he the firstborn son of Abraham's seed? No, right? Because of the whole bit with Hagar. So it's a little bit different, but the non-firstborn son, who's the firstborn son of Sarah, inherits the promise. And then you go down and you have Isaac having these two boys, Jacob and Esau, who are fighting each other in the womb. Esau comes out first. Jacob's named the heel grabber. Esau should be the one getting the blessing. Esau's the one that Jacob wants to give the blessing to, but God has promised that it's going to happen through Jacob. So the story comes to the second born Jacob, and you get all that going on. And it happens again with Ephraim and Manasseh. It's easy to go past, because those last three chapters of Genesis are a bit, I don't know, they're epilogue. You know, it's kind of downplayed. The big stuff has happened. Joseph has forgiven his brothers. I mean, there'll be a little more of that. But, you know, it's sort of like when the hobbits go back and find Sharky. Sharky, come on, Tolkien. You got tired by that point calling him Sharky. And then they go back and they find Saruman taking over the Hobbiton. and whatnot, the Shire. It's that level of storytelling. You're just kind of like, okay, story's over, winding down. And it's not bad, right? It's not bad, but it's easy to go past it. But at this moment, when Ephraim and Manasseh are both made brothers of Judah and Reuben and Simeon, right? They're pretty young. They're like toddlers or smaller on Joseph's knees. And Joseph takes them off his knees and he sets them on the ground before Israel, before Jacob, as this promise is being spoken. And Israel, you know, he's getting ready to die. So he's passing the covenant on. And Joseph knows this. So he places Manasseh on his left side, so he will be on Jacob's right side, and therefore receive the right hand blessing, which is the big one, the real one, right? The more powerful position is to be at a king's right hand. And he puts Ephraim on the left. And then he bows his face down to the ground before his father, which is pretty cool. I should do that sometime. I don't know. My dad might not like that. He might be a little embarrassed by it. what a respect for God. Yeah. Anyhow, Jacob then, the text tells us that his eyes were dim. Like he couldn't see as well. And it's almost like, oops. Oh, wait, but what happened to Jacob back in the day? Right? Who took advantage of somebody's dim eyes? So it's kind of like oops, but it's kind of not. Because to do this, he basically crosses his arms. He puts his right hand across his chest so it's on the head of Ephraim. And his left hand across his chest so it's on the head of Manasseh. And from there, he gives his blessing. Now, Joseph sees this. And he's not so stoked about the idea. I don't know if he's kind of brought his head up by now. Maybe he'd been standing, you know, he got back up from the kneeling, but imagine kind of, he's on the ground, his nose is on the ground, his eyeballs kind of turned up trying to see what's going on. He sees this happen. He gets up, he grabs his father's hands. What a disrespect for God. He grabs his father's hands and attempts to move them back to where he thinks they ought to be. He says, no way. My father, this is the firstborn right here. Come on. I know you're getting old and all, but come on. And Jacob's like, no. He's got great words. I'll try not to use my high-pitched squeakies on him. He says, I know, my son. I know. He also shall become a people. And he also shall be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be greater than he. And his offspring shall become a multitude of nations. I mean, that's Ephraim's promise right there. That is some sweet stuff. Yeah. Big deal. Son of Joseph. And yeah, he's going to rock it all the way. And again, it's not as though Manasseh doesn't get to partake in this a little bit, because Israel, Jacob, goes on to say, by you, meaning these two boys, Israel, meaning not me, but the tribes, that, you know, the children who shall come of these promises, will pronounce blessings saying, God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. Right? So it's kind of like, you imagine your favorite whatever, in whatever you like. Yeah? Basketball, video games, theology, right? May God make you like that guy. That's what they would say of Ephraim. And Manasseh too. And of all their descendants. And of all their descendants. And this really, it plays itself out as they move forward through Exodus and through the wandering in the wasteland and through the entry into the kingdom, because of all the tribes that are there, and they're all, you know, they're all got to do their duty here and go to war against whoever. But you know who is the vanguard? The Spartans of Israel? Yeah, it's Ephraim. You don't mess with Ephraim. They are some serious, powerful, wealthy, healthy dudes and dudettes. Been a long time since I said dudettes, and I did never plan to say it about Ephraimites, but nonetheless. Jeroboam, son of Nebat, he's an Ephraimite. And he's watching this little punk, horse-faced pipsqueak Rehoboam sit up there talking about how he's going to be twice as hard as his father. And he's like, yo, what do I have to do with David? Judah? I mean, yeah, you were born to Leah before, you know, all that hootenanny with the servant ladies and whatnot. But, like, Ephraim was a grandson of Rachel. And we've always more than doubled you in numbers. What would you be without us? Hey, all y'all other guys, sons of not Judah, what do you say we just ignore this guy?
Follow me.
And they do. They do. He heads up to the north. He sets up his own little kingdom there. And all of Israel follows him at that point. And the southern kingdom never really recovers quite, especially militarily. They'll have a high point, kind of, under a couple guys, Jehoshaphat, who dies in battle, right? So, not really, right? They really needed Ephraim the whole time. And you do got to see that this is also where Samaritanism eventually comes in. The Samaritans are effectively northern kingdomites. And then Jeroboam's the one who sets up the splinter in their religion from that of the Hebrew, eventually to be called Jewish religion. He does this because in his belief about what he needs to do to distinguish himself from the house of David, and the house of David's in Jerusalem, and in Jerusalem there's a temple, and at that temple is the only place that sacrifices to Yahweh can be made, and so he doesn't want his people going down there because he doesn't, you know, I guess he's afraid that he's going to not be able to keep those people. And so he sets up his own forms of worship in the name of Yahweh initially, but increasingly towards Baal worship. And so the result of that splinter that he creates, this leads to everything else that happens in the north all the way down to Jezebel. So that's Jeroboam the first, right? And you really should know his name.
An unstoppable force.
But Jeroboam the second, a little tougher. I'm really not kidding, because once again, you're going to run into the alphabet soup of names. Because Jeroboam the second is the son of Joash. But the thing is, there's more than one Joash, and they're both kind of almost ruling about the same time. So he is the son of the Joash who ruled in northern Israel, who himself is the son of Jehoash. Oh, that makes it easy, doesn't it? No, but he's the son of Jehoash, who himself is the son of Jehoahaz, who himself is the son of Jehu. And I don't want you to remember anybody there. I mean, you can, but don't worry about it. I want you to remember Jehu. Because Jehu is the guy who Elijah, that marvelous prophet who slaughtered the prophets of Baal and stood up to Jezebel, right? Who fled away, ate some bread brought by ravens in the wilderness, went to Sinai, and there in Sinai receives from God, did I ever say this in this podcast? Not a still small voice, but an actual word of God telling him to go and anoint Jehu to destroy the house of Jeroboam. Huh? Jezebel being not directly of the house, but married to the guy, Ahab, who is descended from Jeroboam at that time, right? So that's Jehu. Jehu does this. You go way back. I forget which episode it was. We do this story with the Revelation series where, you know, the whole thing ends with Jezebel being thrown out a window and eaten by dogs. I mean, it is a gnarly story. So good. That's Jehu. So Jehu to Jehoahaz to Jehoash to Joash, Joash king of Judah, around the time that Elisha dies, has a kid, he names him Jeroboam. Why on earth, if you are the descendant, fifth generation, fourth generation descendant of a man who took the kingdom by overthrowing a king, why would you name your son after the guy that got overthrown? Isn't that weird? Anyway, that's Jeroboam the second. Jeroboam II, king of Israel, reigns in Samaria 41 years. He was evil. He did the things that Jeroboam had set up, which had been a problem all along. He did restore the border of Israel from Lebo Hamath as far as the Sea of Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke by his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, who was from Geth-hepher. I'm not sure we have that reference point. It's one of those places where we have a word from a prophet that wasn't written, and we don't have. In any case, the Lord saw that the affliction of Israel was bitter, none left, bond or free, to help them. But he said he would not blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, so he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. So he actually does very well as a king, in spite of his great evil. So that's the guy during whose reign Hosea is prophesying. Ugh. And once more, for historical perspective, this is between 790 and 725 BC, 800 years before Jesus. Quite a few, 200 years before the exile? And 100 years after the first prophet to write books that would show up in the Book of the 12, Obadiah, during the reign of Joram of Judah, who, again, you may not know his name, that's okay. He has a son named Joash, and their story is all connected to that Jezebel lady through her daughter, Athaliah. Now, before we dig into that, let's hit two birds with one stone and try to bring this week, at least, to a close here, so that Joash of Judah, who marries Athaliah, the daughter of Jezebel, is during his time period that Joel prophesies. So again, back to our whole point here, right? You have this Book of the 12, three segments, pre-exile, exile, and post-exile. And in each segment, they're not chronological, but they're thematic. Although sometimes they're chronological. When they're not being thematic, they go chronological. And you also have this other wrinkle of a north-south bounce. Hosea, the first book, sets the tone for all of the first part of the Book of the 12. He prophesies to the north during the reign of Jeroboam II. And the next book, Joel, prophesies to the south during the reign of Joash. Obadiah, which we've mentioned, is the fourth book, right? But the first book written. It's written during the reign of Joash's father, Joram of Judah, not to be confused with Joram of northern Israel. Yeah?
Right.
But I don't know that I have a way to help you remember that part. I mean, it's Henry VIII, Henry V, Henry IV. I mean, is that kind of problem, right? You just have to kind of know the story and the number, I suppose. Or I guess we could have a little fun with it. I mean, we can call Joram from the south good old boy Joram. Or maybe redneck Joram, you can take your pick. Kind of like good old boy. Old boy Joram. And then, of course, from the north, Joram from the north, he's got to be Yankee Joram, right? So, old boy Joram, good old boy. Good old boy Joram and his son, good old boy, Joash. Their story is pretty fascinating because it's tied into Jezebel and the death of her family, which again is prophesied by Elijah and Jehu's all tied into this at a certain point. But this before that really has taken place, in its entirety at least. Good old boy Joram of Judah does a not good old boy thing, and he marries the daughter of Jezebel. Athaliah is her name. And this is problematic in a number of ways. But you know, the prescriptions of the Torah are things like, you know, don't marry witches. Right? Don't marry foreign wives to begin with, and Jezebel definitely was a foreign wife, the daughter of the witch king of Sidon. And this comes up in the Gospels when Jesus runs into a lady from Sidon who has faith in him, and the people around him from Israel don't, which is a pretty fascinating little piece there, yeah? But Ahab shouldn't have married her in the first place, but he did. He's a son of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, so he's kind of into that sort of dumb decision-making thing, yeah? But good old boy Joram, he should have known better. I mean, he's in sort of a faithful line. He's the son of Jehoshaphat. And although I get it, jumping Jehoshaphat, like what on earth does that mean? Where did that phrase come from? I don't know. But Jehoshaphat is actually a pretty cool character. Pretty cool real character, real guy. And he's faithful. So Joram should know better. Or should he? As it turns out, Jehoshaphat, while often making great decisions, also made some pretty poor ones. And this is important to keep in mind for all of these kings, north and south. Very rarely, I mean, Jezebel's an exception, but very rarely are there bad decisions made with malicious intent. They're the kinds of things that if we looked at it now in our political atmosphere, wanting our nation to do well, we wouldn't necessarily say that's wrong what he did there. I mean, we might if we understood motivation and or idolatry, right? But aside from that, politically, so why does Joram, good old boy, marry the daughter of Yankee witch Jezebel? Because his father, faithful, good old boy Jehoshaphat, wants to make a political alliance with the North to strengthen his military positions in dealing with his desire to, you know, defend himself. Expand his trade, build ships, and so he forms this alliance, and it ends up in the long run going very well for Judah financially and militarily. Jehoshaphat's going to live a pretty long life. He's going to be able to put down the enemies of Israel, north and south, including the Moabites, kind of ancient enemies. But all of this means he has to let his son marry this witch. I think I've told this story on the podcast before, but it's worth telling again.
Like Baba Yaga.
And everything maybe seems fine for a while, and we're going to fast forward the story quite a bit. The faithlessness of this whole situation has brought on challenges to the good old nation of Judah, including things like rebellions, the Edomites who had been in submission since David's time. These are the sons of Esau, right? They revolt, and they're never going to be subject again. The Philistines and the Petrian Arabians begin attacking and eventually even assault the city of Jerusalem itself. They end up sacking the palace. They carry off some of the wives and sons of the king, with the exception of Ahaziah, the son of Joram, Ahaziah. All the other sons of Joram are taken captive by Arabians. Yeah, not necessarily ever to be seen again. Soon after this, Joram gets afflicted by a painful disease, a revolting disease. And he ends up being dead, and his son Ahaziah takes the throne. So Ahaziah is the son of Athaliah, right? So now you have on the throne a king of Judah whose brothers are gone, whose grandmother is Jezebel, right? And he gets killed after only a year by Jehu. Oh yeah, that guy. Who's fulfilling the prophecies to destroy all of Ahab's line? Yeah? And at this point, literally all hell breaks loose. Athaliah, she takes over. She takes over. And then proceeds to kill all of Ahaziah's sons, all of her own grandchildren. Now, you got two reasons. What on earth, lady? What are you doing? Right? Killing your own grandkids. Well, if you've seized the throne and you don't want anybody to have a claim to the throne later, those who would be the rightful heirs to the throne would be the ones you want to get rid of, right? So you got that. But then you got something more, something deeper, something maybe a bit more diabolical. As bad as Ahaziah was, as foolhardy as Joash was, and as bad as he was, as bad as the kings of Judah ever get under even Manasseh himself. Named, interestingly, isn't it, for Manasseh, the blessed one from whose house he did not come. In any case, as bad as it ever gets, there's always something there. It's the same reason that even though God punishes Solomon by ripping the kingdom out of the hands of Rehoboam, he says, I'm not going to rip it out of your hands, Solomon, out of love for David, and the promises, love for the promises I have made to David, that one of his descendants would sit upon the throne of the world forever. So Ahaziah, when he is slain by Jehu as a son of Ahab and Jezebel, is also a son of David, the last rightful heir of his generation, given that his brothers are all gone, taken by those Arabians. And so his sons are also heirs of David. David, the one loved by Yahweh. Yahweh, the one who causes so much trouble for Baal. Baal, the one worshipped with such devotion and zeal by Jezebel. Jezebel, who wants to see all the words of the Lord exterminated. Jezebel, whose daughter Athaliah is, whose religion Athaliah has, whose zeal Athaliah may indeed also share. And so she sees a moment not to seize the throne for herself, but to avenge her family and her God against the prophecies that Yahweh through Elijah and Jehu has brought to bear against them. And so even though they're her own grandkids, she also knows they're the only hope of Judah, the only hope of the line of David, and she kills him. She kills all of them in a hasty, bloody, gory, horror movie moment within the castle, right as her own husband is being slaughtered. All of them, except one. One-year-old boy, hidden in a bedchamber, the absolute last heir to the promise of David, which means to the promise of Jacob, Isaac, Abraham, Noah, and Eve. Like a basket dropped into the waters of the Nile, like a man and his virgin bride on a donkey heading out of Bethlehem, little baby boy in a bedchamber, hidden by a woman, not a nursemaid. She's actually the wife of the high priest at the time. She's also Athaliah's daughter, a grandchild of Jezebel, a cousin to this boy. She hides him with the soldiers, moving about looking, people screaming, blood being shed everywhere, the entire kingdom in disarray and uproar. You think the Bible's boring.
There's more.
Right.
No doubt the facts have been exaggerated.
Yes.
Namely,
you know, Bobby, I'm
unstoppable force.
Insane.
Insane.
Well,
the city's inhabitants are losing their minds.
Trigger warning. This ain't a safe space.
Compulsory insanity.
By going.
Yes, completely, utterly.
Genius. If you're doing what everyone else is doing, you're doing it
mad.
Was that worth a dollar? Click the Patreon link in the show notes to sign up. Pretty please? Ha ha ha.